The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Jason Freeman, and I work here in the author events office, and I'm honored to introduce Roddy Doyle and Wesley Stace this evening. A quintessentially Irish writer, Dublin-born Roddy Doyle has found an enthusiastic international audience through his empathetic working-class characters and their hard-wrought relationships, their vivid dialogue, and the relatable stories he tells that speak not only to Irish culture and history, but to something identifiable in the larger human experience. Mr. Doyle's penned work across an astonishing array of genres. He's the author of 10 novels, 7 children's books, 7 plays and screenplays, a memoir, and a slew of short stories. He's perhaps best known for the Barrytown trilogy of novels, including The Commitments, which was later made into a film loved by many people, including me. Among many other honors, Mr. Doyle won the Booker Prize for his novel Patty Clark, Ha Ha Ha. His new book is called The Guts, and it returns to the rabbit family of the Barrytown trilogy. An NPR review called it, quote, a novel filled with so much joyful love and life and song that it might, picture this, it might even have made Samuel Beckett smile, end quote. Also joining us on stage tonight is Wesley Stace, another writer from across the pond who also dazzles audiences with the breathtaking range of his work. He's the author of 3 previous critically acclaimed novels, including Misfortune, named one of the best books of the year by the Washington Post, and Charles Jessel, considered as a murderer, one of the Wall Street Journal's best fiction books of 2011. You may also know Mr. Stace by his rock and roll pen name, John Wesley Harding, who has released 15 folk rock albums characterized by smart, literary lyrics, biting delivery, and an Elvis Costello meets Bob Dylan, dark and sometimes surreal sense of humor, overlaying profound culture, cultural and political comment. Well, that's my own take anyway. He's performed on such shows as Late Night with Conan O'Brien, The Late Show with David Letterman, and is the founder of the Cabinet of Wonders variety show, which has featured a who's who of contemporary musicians, writers, comedians, and many other types of performers. Mr. Stace's new novel is about, maybe not so surprisingly, the rock and roll lifestyle. It's called Wonder Kid, and Roseanne Cash, rock royalty in her own right, wrote that it has both enormous entertainment value and serious literary worth, a very hard trick to pull off. So that maybe we can learn a bit about how he did indeed do it, won't you all please join me in first welcoming Wesley Stace to the stage.
Thank you. So I think we're both going to read and then talk, Q&A. This novel is not actually released for a month, but my publishers were so keen for me to be able to read it for you this evening that they've had copies especially printed. So if you want one... If you want one a month early, you can cancel your Amazon pre-order and just buy it here. And it's a delight to see them because it's the first book I've ever seen with different coloured end papers. As a book lover, I've never seen that before, ever. So it's about a band. They're a normal band. Their music is redesigned, A&R'd for children, toddlers. They become enormous and at great personal cost to themselves. It's a deal they make. They sing the same songs, it's just that their audience are wearing diapers. It's a very different thing. I'm going to read a little bit from before. And there's no blue. Now this kind of music is huge. Dan Zane's, The Wiggles. You or your children might have heard of it, or your grandchildren. But the back then, they have no blueprint. And so I'm going to read a little bit before, on his way to fame. And his name is Blake Lear, and he has a brother called Jack. And I'm going to read a little bit after Fame. Jack didn't go to university. Blake won a place at Angels College. There, avoiding an unseemly amount of work, he began to tinker in bands, briefly gigging as keyboard player for Replicants, who were for the workers' revolution, for Gary Numan, and against definite articles. Humping the keyboard was bad enough. The ironing board stand was worse. Blake could hardly play the synth, but Replicants' music required only one finger, either depressed on the Casio or raised to society. More important were hair and lighting. The lead singer was less concerned with the quality of the lyrics. Blake's suggestions were laughed out of the union bar. His tenancy was up. But in the unlikely event that Replicants ever made it, he'd unavoidably end up a twig on a peat frame rock family tree. It was a step in the right direction. Blake read English literature and made it his business to find out how to pass exams. This useful knowledge was wholly unrelated to any study of the subject itself. It involved the thorough analysis of old exam papers to discern the frequency with which certain questions popped up, and then the learning by heart of the appropriate essays. With regard to practical criticism, every essay was successfully handled by making a lengthy case that the poem was about writing a poem, or failing that, that the poem was about the condition of art itself. He sailed through his part ones and took a job at the Art Cinema, for which he wrote the occasional précis for the calendar, always of films he'd never seen, always in a last-minute rush, and where he ushered, nipping down to the toilets for crafty cigarettes when he'd had one too many appointments with Dr. Caligari. He still had his four or five guitar chords and was putting them to good effect on basic protest songs, mostly written by more famous, more American, older practitioners, for whose songs he'd changed the name of, say, Richard Nixon, to, say, Margaret Thatcher. And Bob's your uncle. This edified the student masses in a way Replicants could only dream of. It felt a little punky, but it was Blake's way in. A girlfriend called Caroline introduced him to the more whimsical end of English progressive rock. He'd always hated that scene, not to mention the attendant literature, mostly because of the hairy crowd who'd been into it at school, masturbating on their electric guitars as they broadcast only into their own headphones, extolling the virtues of harmonics and tricky time signatures. But in Caroline's musical world, there were no elves, no Roger Dean scapes, no Lord of the Rings, just solid British whimsy. Caravan, sipping tea with a golf girl in their land of grey and pink. Stackridge and their indifferent hedgehogs. And best of all, Robert Wyatt's Rock Bottom. Caroline and he shared their first kiss watching fireworks from his window, and Robert Wyatt sang words that made perfect sense, and none at all. Burly Bunch, the Water Mole. He had never met a girl who didn't want to use tongues before. It seemed like some bizarre backward step beyond pre-puberty. Heliplop and fingerhole. The license to specialise for the first time, to zero in on something of actual interest, suited Blake, and he decided to write a dissertation on nonsense poetry, surveying his parent favourites from Lear and Carroll onwards. He was supervised for this by a thrilled bishop, dusted off especially for their tutorials. Monsignor Arbuthnot Slade had written lengthily on the subject himself with particular reference to Edward Lear, the Ingoldsby legends and the Bab ballads, and was delighted to find a student willing to look forward to contemporary poetry, for this had been the bishop's problem for many years. After the Victorians, what? Blake, to the bishop's frustration, was prepared to stretch the definition of nonsense to breaking point, happy to include poets and poems from which other minds derived perfect sense. Blake preferred not to understand them, neither the poets nor the minds. In many regards, the bishop and Blake were an imperfect match, an owl and a pussycat, a nutcracker and sugar tongs, yet they happily danced by the light of the moon every Tuesday for two terms. The bishop had no grounds on which to argue whether Bob Dylan wrote nonsense, not having heard the music of Bob Dylan, nor indeed any popular music since Gilbert and, rather than Gilbert O, Sullivan. But he introduced Blake to the following verse of Lewis Carroll, written in 1889. He thought he saw a buffalo upon the chimney piece. He looked again and found it was his sister's husband's niece. Unless you leave this house, he said, I'll send for the police. Blake was delighted, and when he told his fellow music fans that this was a lost lyric from Blonde on Blonde, particularly when he delivered it in septum-quivering Dylanese, they believed him. Who wouldn't? And how different really was it from the sky being chicken and saddling up a goose and the key being Frank and all that rubbish? We think so then, and we thought so still, wrote Edward Lear, of which Dylan's version was about being younger then and older than that now. Why was one nonsense and the other profound? Blake laughed at those who extracted deep meaning from Bob Dylan's lyric, agreed the man was a genius, but only in as much as he was the greatest nonsense writer of the late 20th century. When you added it up, and people often tried, there were plenty of professors waxing lyrical. The only line connecting Dylan's work after his brief flirtation with sense, the folky protest period, was nonsense. He was capable of writing either great nonsense, everything up to John Wesley Harding, or sense composed entirely of atrocious cliché, everything else. It was as if Dylan, it seemed to Blake, was only successful when he wrote crap. Of course the man didn't want to explain his lyrics. He couldn't. Even the best of his narratives were completely nonsensical. And while everybody else was trying to make sense of text by deconstructing them and decoding signs, Blake was on the lookout for things that tried to mean nothing, that stopped making sense, as David Byrne was currently advising at the Art Cinema. Blake started to gravitate towards poetry that barely coalesced into words, while simultaneously arguing that T.S. Eliot was essentially a nonsense poet. The Four Quartets, weren't these best heard and appreciated as gobbledygook, as pure sound rather than teased and tickled for meaning that might or might not be there, upon which, anyway, no one would ever agree? The bishop, while full of admiration for his pupil's gusto, was happiest wading in the shallows. Slade's nonsense was literary, a construct in opposition to sense, always on the threshold of knowledge. Blake's church was broader, more Catholic even than the Monsignor's. He viewed all poetry, all literature, through this prism. Auden, Blake, Empson, Smith, they were all failed nonsense poets. They didn't have the nerve for it. What a waste. Bits of Finnegan's Wake, though, read like Edward Lear's letters. And then he thought of a name for his dissertation. King Lear. Nonsense was for adults, but children got it. It was pure pleasure and embarrassment to academia. I'll go through a little bit here. He was, it goes without saying, not always at his most alert during these tutorials. Blake allotted a portion of his student grant to the various herbs and chemicals that might enhance his enjoyment of and enlighten his attitude towards nonsense, music, and anything else he fell over. He was not alone. Such beneficial substances were the currency of the college bars, freely available to anyone with money. Thus it was, during an acid trip, after a late-night horror film at the Art Cinema, that he came up with his most inevitably bad idea. The first bad idea had been to watch it on acid, a slasher movie, the true bloody-humoured brutality of which had been severely misrepresented in the programme précis that he himself had written. It had been around the time that a decapitated corpse held its own severed head above the body of a screaming woman tied to a hospital operating table and attempted cunnilingus with her, that Blake wondered whether the acid had been prudent. As he walked home across the green, watching the earth shift underfoot like a million squiggling worms, it dawned on him the lack of nerve was his own. When he got home, he smoked a joint, put aside a Beckett essay, and began to write the dissertation that would win him his first. The fateful idea, formally interesting, philosophically unique, academically suicidal was to write his dissertation about nonsense in the form of nonsense. The bishop pleaded with him, prayed, all that research, all those modern ideas, all was lost. The bishop, with a rueful smile, wished Blake well, reiterated what a pleasure it had been meeting with him so regularly, and assured him that he should reconsider or regret it for the rest of his life. Blake left wondering whether all the bishop required was an ideal child friend to take him by the hand, row him out onto the lake, and then wave goodbye. Blake left without a degree. The dissertation was unusually ruled unmarkable, thus nullifying other fairly good results across the board. He hadn't completed the course. Neither his advisor nor his father could prevail upon him to take a substitute exam. And so, rather than becoming an academic or a top man at the BBC, he came home and, after a sufficiency of lolling around, took twin jobs as a primary school teacher by day and cinema usher by night. That was when the band got going. At the primary school, Blake liked nothing more than making up songs with the kids. He'd suggest a melody, write a line, and then let them make the rest up, waiting until they got stuck, listening for their loopy attempts at rhyme. He'd then transcribe it all, sculpt a little here and there, and bingo, it was a song. Most songwriters get accused of plagiarism once or twice, some notably more often, but there are a few school kids out there who could have their day in court with Blake Lear. Tough to prove, but he loved to take the words right out of their mouths. It's a lyric. I like it when we're going, I don't like it when we stop. And you look like you have a new haircut on. There's a bonus point for knowing when the firefly lights up. You get a fresh shirt with a pink button. I was bored, but I perked up. I was bored, but I perked up. I was bored. Now I'm all worked up. I'm not bored anymore. I've got some new fresh air for my nose. It's Blake, for sure. Blake and the children of James Lewis's class at Arundale Primary School. Okay, thank you very much, and I'm just going to read one little bit from later on in his life. So the band crashes and burns, and this happens a little bit later. The first thing I knew about Judith Esther's The Dark-Headed Clock trilogy was the first thing most people knew about it. It was everywhere. You probably had a better idea if you were in primary school, chatting in the playground or reading a book trade journal. But for the rest of us, the ones without children, those outside the publishing industry, there was nothing, a vacuum. And then there was The Dark-Headed Clock. At first, there were stacks of the first volume on the front tables of bookshops, cheeky, gothic cover luring you in. Then its spine started appearing on the shelves you least expected, in friends' houses, on your manager's bedside cabinet, behind the Prime Minister's head in an interview on TV. Apparently, the first volume, The Toll of the Dark-Headed Clock, was one of those books enjoyed by both children and their parents alike, similar to the Pullman books and the Harry Potter books, of which the Judith Esther book seemed to me paying the scantest attention a big rip-off, although I'd never read the Harry Potters and only seen two of the films, both as hotel pay-per-views, as a sleep aid. Then there were posters in the Underground advertising the second in the trilogy, The Shadow of the Dark-Headed Clock, which morphed imperceptibly into posters advertising a movie of the first volume, featuring many stars, mainly British, directed by a recent Oscar-winning Yank. Waiting at a bus stop in autumn, one looked down to see a frantically ripped open and then rapidly discarded wrapper from some Dark-Headed Clock trading cards. Christmas would bring Dark-Headed Clock sponsored Christmas decorations down Regent Street, as surely as beneath them Hamley's window would bulge with fake snow and dark clocks of various shapes and sizes made in China. In reality, this took a few years, I suppose, but in life as it is lived time, it happened overnight. It was like someone said, let there be Dark-Headed Clock, and there was dark-headed clock, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It was one of those phenomena that is felt everywhere, in casual jokes on TV chat shows, in the pop charts, in Halloween costumes, in questions in the Houses of Parliament, and in comment for and against in the newspapers. Some liked its message, some did not. The dark-headed clock trilogy consisted of the classic Toll, the commercially superior sequel, Shadow, and the climactic Midnight in the dark-headed clock, the biggest seller of them all, whispered by some to be a disappointing finale, though the franchise had by now reached critical mass and couldn't possibly underperform. And I will also remind you that it was about twin boys, one with blonde hair, Bill, and one with dark, Ed, their father, conspicuously absent in fine fairy story fashion, who discover, Toll, confront, Shadow, and battle, Midnight, a secret cadre of scientists perpetrating an enormous and terrifying fraud upon the general populace for their own selfish gain. The trilogy was heavy on the Christian allegory, lauded by none other than the Archbishop of Canterbury, attacked by no less than Richard Dawkins, and even seemed to include, to the distress of rationalists everywhere, a subliminal course in self-realization, combining Christian philosophy with elements of those weird books like The Secret, which sell a million copies, but no one really knows what they're about or why anyone is reading them. And there was a whole lot of lies, plenty of witch, and shelf upon shelf of wardrobe, and certainly no need for me to read them because you pick them up just by osmosis. And I do remember thinking one specific thing, however, one night on public transport going home. There were 30 people in the train carriage, and six of them, 20%, were reading one or other volume of the fucking dark-headed clock. And what I remember thinking, knowing whatever it was that I knew of these books, what I remember thinking was, Blake would have absolutely hated those books. And of course, Blake did hate them, which was unfortunate, really, because he wrote them. Thank you very much. Now, welcome to the stage, Roddy Doyle.
Thank you. This book is about a middle-aged man with cancer living through a recession. But it's Friday night. And I was going to read a sensitive kind of piece from the beginning, but I'm not. I'm going to read a more raucous piece towards the end. Jimmy Rabbit used to manage a band of Commitments. I, for want of a better word, invented them 28 years ago. January 1986, I started the Commitments. And then decided to bring him back once Ireland fell into another recession. I thought, well, here we go. And I decided to bring him back to life, you know, went up to the attic and found him, and added more than a quarter of a century to his life. Poor bastard when you think about it. He stopped living at 21 and woke up again at 47 with cancer. But anyway, he has had cancer of the bowel. It's no surprise. I'm not giving anything away. He doesn't die. And he's going to a rock festival called the Electric Picnic, which takes place in the Midlands of Ireland late August, the last weekend of August, I think, every year. And I've gone myself for the last 5 years, and it's great. It's really, really good. So he goes there with his brother Les, who he doesn't really know because he hasn't had much contact with Les over the last 20 years, and another new friend of his called Des, who he doesn't really know either, but wants to. And an old friend, Outspan Foster, who used to play guitar in the Commitments, but Jimmy lost contact with him until he found him at chemotherapy when they were both there. So these four men are going to the Electric Picnic. I don't think you need to know anything else other than that. Jesus, Outspan, it's grand. It's fucking Darfur. Okay, said Outspan. Okay, but it's kind of Southside Darfur. He had a point. It looked like a refugee camp, but it was filling up with blonde girls in shorts and flowery wellies. None of them looked hungry. It wasn't too mucky yet, but it had been pissing down all the way from Dublin, and Jimmy could feel the months of rain just under his feet, waiting to fuck up the weekend. I want my yurt, he said. They'd come and out Span's ex's car. He'd phoned Jimmy that morning to tell him. "I hacked up blood in front of her," he'd said. Outspan, by the way, has cancer of the lungs. And she relented. "My dad's happy enough to give us his." "No," said Outspan, "I have it now, so we may as well run the arse off it." Jimmy didn't want to be involved in some kind of marital vendetta. Outspan's wife was bound to be a hard woman. "But okay," he said. "One thing but," said Outspan. "What?" "Can you drive us?" "Okay," said Jimmy, "no bother." "I'd do it myself," said Outspan, "but I can't." "'Cause of your meds?" "No," said Outspan, "I'm banned." "Grand," said Jimmy. Des had cycled to Jimmy's, and Aoife had given them a lift to his dad's. Les had been waiting for them, dressed like a man who did some serious walking. "I bet he has a Swiss army knife," said Jimmy. "Shut up," said Aoife, "and a fucking compass." The three of them had walked down to Outspan's, past Imelda's. Her car wasn't there. Outspan was standing in the garden. "Will it rain?" "Between now and Sunday night," said Jimmy. "Bring your fucking coat." "This is Les and Des." He only copped on now how stupid that sounded. "Leslie and Des," he said. "Leslie and Desley," said Outspan. Outspan didn't do smiling, so it was a good few seconds before the four of them were laughing together. Then they were all in the car and gone. It was a bit awkward at first. Les in the back said nothing to Des, and Des said nothing to Les. Outspan had the atlas. "Left or right here, Outspan? Do they do lefts and rights down here?" Jimmy said nothing about the rain, even when he had to slow down because he could see fuck all through it. He could already imagine it seeping through his clothes. Before he'd heard one note or eaten a chip, he'd be soggy for the whole weekend. He wouldn't be able to bend his legs because of all the water in his jeans. "They say it'll be nice tomorrow and Sunday," said Des. "Cunts," said Outspan. It was just four men who didn't know one another, including, especially, the two brothers. They were going through Kildare before they laughed again, when they passed a dead fox at the side of the road. "Right or left, me bollocks," said Outspan. They'd parked in a field that must have had hay in it the day before. They followed the line of cars further and further in. The ground felt solid enough under the car. "It's well organised, isn't it?" That was always a surprise. "Should be an Olympic event, synchronised parking. We'd be in with a shout." They were really starting to enjoy themselves until they got out and opened the boot. "Tents," said Jimmy. "Yeah," said Outspan. "We don't need tents," said Jimmy. "We kind of do," said Outspan. "What about the yurt?" "Too dear. You said it wasn't a problem." "Well, it was," said Outspan. "I did me sums wrong." If the other two lads, the pair of liggers who were getting in for nothing, were embarrassed, they weren't showing it. "Why didn't you tell me?" said Jimmy. Outspan looked at Jimmy like he was going to jump on him or sink into the ground. "It's fine," said Des. "Les took a tent out of the boot. Sorted." Jimmy took the other one. It was very light. Before Des and Outspan could grab it, he pushed a blanket to the side and saw the oxygen. He thought he'd fucking die. "It's just in case," said Outspan. "Will we bring it?" "No," said Outspan. Jimmy knew now why Outspan had borrowed the ex's car, or stolen it. He could have done with a blast of the oxygen himself, and so could Leslie and Desley, judging by the pair of earnest heads on them. The slabs of beer saved them. "Never heard of this one," said Jimmy. "Excelsior." "It's not the worst," said Outspan, "and it was good value." "Where?" "Lidl." "Grand. I got the tents there as well," said Outspan. "How much?" €17. Les laughed. He looked at Outspan. "You're serious?" "Each," said Outspan. Les hoisted a tent onto his back and got one of the slabs out of the boot. And that was a new worry. Les thought there might have been a bit of a history there. Les and the drink. It might have been something his mother had once said, or just something he'd imagined. There was something too careful about the way Les carried himself. But fuck it, he grabbed the slab, or he tried to. It was heavy. He got it up onto his shoulder, and it was immediately awkward and sore. He had his bag as well. He'd never make it. "Let's go." Now they stood at the edge of Darfur. Jimmy was sweating like a bastard. The walk from the car to the gate, the wrong fucking gate, to the right gate to here had killed him. He was glad he'd let the hair grow because the sweat, the fucking lard, would have been running straight down his face into his eyes. But he'd made it, and he was happy. His breathing would be normal again in a minute, and the breeze was already working away at the sweat. They weren't ready to go in deeper yet, although the sun was out and the field of tents looked quite pleasant. "Jesus, men," said Des, "we're old." The truth of that was funny. It loosened them up, made them feel a bit brave. A steady line of kids kept passing them to grab their places further in. It was early afternoon. Jimmy checked his watch. It was only just after 2. We're missing Joe Duffy. Who's Joe Duffy? Les asked. Cunt on the radio, said Elspan. We right, lads. They picked up the gear, the tents, the bag, the sleeping bag, the slabs of beer, the Wellingtons, and got ready to walk into the heart of darkness. Les led the way. Jimmy could see none of the young Les in him. There was nothing of the kid left. Young Outspan was still in the current Outspan, but young Les was gone. It made Jimmy sad and guilty. He couldn't really remember what Les had been like. When Jimmy had met him the night before, the only reason he'd known it was Les was the fact that he was standing in their parents' kitchen, and he couldn't have been anyone else. But it wasn't like he was damaged or twitchy or anything like that. He seemed grand. He was fit. He didn't have much to say, but that was all right too. He'd gone ahead a bit, and Jimmy wanted to run after him, chat to him, ingratiate himself, make up for the decades. Look, it was someone their own age. That's a fucking relief. There were more over near the edge of the camp, normal-looking people. The picnic was supposed to be for the more mature music lovers, and there were about 9 of them here. There'd be more arriving later, Jimmy supposed, after work. Outspan was struggling. All right, grand. Do you want the rest? No. He stopped. He looked lost for a second, gone. Then he was alive again. It was fucking madness, though. He was going to die. Here. Les had found them a spot. Himself and Des were sitting on the tent packs by the time Jimmy and Outspan got there, and Les had opened a can. Outspan dropped beside them and grabbed a can too before he slipped back into his little coma and woke again. The business, what? He said. He was some boy. They clinked cans. We're here. We fucking are. I like this, said Les. Jesus, said Outspan. Over there. Look, quick. They looked. Do you remember when tits used to look like that, said Outspan. They weren't alone now. In the minute they'd been sitting there, they'd gone from outer suburbs to inner city. Girls pulling wheelie suitcases and boys hauling two-wheeled trolleys with multi-story slabs of beer were surrounding them, claiming their space. The girl that Outspan was pointing out had just gone past in a wheelbarrow, pushed by 2 young lads who looked like they played serious rugby. Outspan's mouth was about a foot away from her ear. Shut up, for fuck's sake. What? They sat there for a bit and relaxed. Ground's damp. Stop whinging. I don't hear any music. It hasn't started yet. So we paid a fortune for fucking silence. Fuck off, said Jimmy. It'll kick off at 4, I think. He took out the programme from his back pocket. He'd printed it out the night before. He had to bring it up to his eyes. He hadn't brought his reading glasses. 4:15, he said. Who's on tonight? Sigur Rós. Who? The XS. The XX. Fucking who? Christy Moore. Ah, for fuck's sake. I like Christy Moore, said Les. We all like Christy Moore, said Outspan. Jimmy hated Christy Moore. But it's like having one of the neighbours getting up on stage, said Outspan. Who else? Someone we know. Come on. Well, I'm going to Christy Moore, said Les. A good old sing-song. Grand, said Jimmy. Maybe Nolene was right. He just automatically hated everything Irish. Why Christy? He asked Les. What do you mean? Is it because you live in England? Come on, said Les. He looked happily angry. You think I'd cry into my pint, pining for home? No, he's good, Jimmy. Okay. You haven't changed. How could he tell? How could Les know what Jimmy had been like 25 years ago, when Jimmy hadn't a clue what Les had been like? I'm happy enough, said Jimmy. I'll watch Christy too. He'll be fucking delighted, said Outspan. Fuck off. He'll write a fucking song about you. Fuck off. Will we put up the tents? In a minute. Anyone hungry? No. Jimmy could feel the heat now on his neck and hands. The ground was cold under them, though, even under plastic. When's it open? Des asked. 3, I think. You didn't answer me question, Rabbit, said Outspan. What question? Who else is playing, said Outspan, that we've heard of? Tonight, come on. Grizzly Bear, never heard of them. I have, said Des. Any good? I don't know, said Des. I know the name, but I don't think I've actually heard them. Ah, now, Desley, for fuck's sake. Dexy's Midnight Runners, said Les. Tomorrow, said Jimmy. Fucking brilliant, said Outspan. 30,000 cunts singing Come On Eileen. They were on their second cans. We should have brought some of those fold-up chairs. We might be able to buy some. My arse is numb, like your fucking head. It was a great few hours, doing nothing, getting to know the other lads. Jimmy liked Les. He liked being with him. He texted Darren, at the picnic with Les, how's the baby? Les was a can ahead of the others, but Jimmy made himself relax. Some of the passing kids stared at him, like they were afraid they'd find their parents with them. We'd better get the tents up or there'll be no room. Good thinking. It was hard standing up, fuck, but good crack erecting the tents, although they seemed a bit light and small and useless. We should have brought some of those inflatable mattresses. Not at all. We'll be grand. They watched Les unrolling a rubber mat. Do we have anything like that? Jimmy asked Outspan. What is it? A yoga mat. Aoife had one like it, except hers had the dog's teeth marks on it and a corner missing. No, said Outspan. What have we? What do you mean? To lie on. The fucking ground. Jimmy tapped the roof of the tent. It was like tapping a stretched silk shirt. Hope it doesn't rain, he said. You're starting to annoy me, Rabbit, said Outspan, although Jimmy could tell that Outspan wasn't annoyed, and he liked that they were slipping into their old selves the way they'd known each other years ago. Just stop fucking whinging, said Outspan. It'll keep the rain out, no bother. Most of it, anyway. Grand. We'll go for a wander, will we? Okay. They threw all the stuff into one of the tents. Will it be safe? Probably not. They followed Les. The ground was intact nearly everywhere. The boggier patches had been filled with wood chippings and bark, small bits of tree. There were people cooking, a gobshite playing a guitar, a few lads already sculled. Jimmy always thought of his own kids when he saw other kids drunk, but he'd parked that one for the weekend. He'd tried to. Any sign of the Jackses? The middle-aged bladder. Fucking terrible, isn't it? Over there, look it. The muck looked more sinister as they got nearer the toilets, a line of plastic windowless phone boxes that looked like they'd already had a hammering. There was a urinal too, a long yellow plastic trough of a thing that was probably used for feeding cattle when the field wasn't full of teenagers from Dublin. It was up against a wire fence, so they pissed while gangs of young ones and lads passed on the other side of the fence and a group of older women who looked like they were normally a book club. Outspan had gone into one of the phone boxes and he'd been in there for a fair while. Is he okay? He's dying. Not now, though, is he? Will I knock? Don't know. But Outspan spared them the decision. He climbed out of the thing like he was getting out of a car. The kid who was next in line for Outspan's jacks waited till Outspan had gone past, then moved to the back of a different queue. All right, said Jimmy. Grand, yeah, said Outspan. That'll do me till Sunday, I'd say. Shouldn't laugh, I know, but it's the silly ones that get you, you know. Ah, good. Look, Darfur had grown four or five times bigger since they'd arrived. The average age had gone up too, and some of the tents had seen serious use. These were people who brought families camping. There was movement. The kids were starting to migrate towards the stages in the main arena. I've changed my mind. What? We're not the ugliest nation in the world. Some of them are lovely, aren't they? Most of them. Fucking all of them, except your woman over there in the Donegal jersey. Were their mothers as good looking? No way. You sure? Positive, said Des. I'd remember. They could hear a band tuning up now, the noise drifting across at them. Who's that? Don't know, said Jimmy. He hated having to admit it. Sounds shite anyway, he said. Are we right? They went back across to their tents. They packed Jack's paper, rain jackets, middle-aged hoodies, and Ambre Solaire. You're fucking optimistic. Into two backpacks. They left everything else. The sun came out, sudden and strong, and Jimmy could see right through their tents. If the sun could do that, what would the fucking rain do? Will we bring the wellies? Fuck the wellies. There were two young lads sitting on folding chairs outside their tent. A better looking tent than Jimmy's. Les turned to them. Gentlemen, what's the crack, man? Said one of the younger lads, a bogger. They were both wearing Donegal, at least Kilkenny jerseys. You staying here for a while? Les asked. Actually, he said it. It wasn't a question. Probably. Keep an eye on our stuff, all right? Oh, right. They wouldn't budge for the night, the poor fuckers. Les wasn't big or muscle-bound or anything like that, but there was something about him. Certainty, solidity. And the English tail in his accent. It made him a bit of a Cray twin. The drink was safe. They could have left their watches and wallets. Thanks, lads. No bother, man. They were on their way, back through expanding Darfur, back past the Jacks. They'd been given wristbands at the outside gate, and now they had to show them again to a stoned-looking security man, and they were in, through, at the picnic. Brilliant. And it was, immediately. Thank you. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Andy. I'm director of Author Events, and I'm very
pleased. And we are Sonny and Cher.
They introduced themselves. I don't need to be here. Folks, if you raise your hand, we'll call on you. If you have a question, please wait for the microphone. Who'd like to start us off?
great.
Good night.
This question's for Mr. Doyle. I just finished your book today. I've read everything you've written, and I thought it was superb.
Oh,
I mean,
thank you.
Really very moving.
Thank you.
The way you deal with cancer in the everyday lives of your characters is extraordinary. In particular, and this I'm leading to my question, is you have a scene where Outspan is lifted by the crowd in this inflatable chair at the Cure concert that I stopped reading because I thought this was a moment that he, and we know Outspan has difficulties more than Jimmy Rabbit, but that he had a moment in his life that seemed to be extraordinary. And my question to you is, in dealing with cancer and in writing about it, you arrived at this point of almost jubilation for the character's difficulties and how you came about that and put it into the story and the significance of it in the story.
Well, thank you very much. Like a lot of people my age, cancer arrived as a topic of conversation about 15 years ago. You know, it used to be music, football, the kids, the work, you know, things like that. And then cancer was added to it. So it became part of my life, and it became the death of friends, and it became, if you like, the survival of friends. So it was observation, really, and attitude. One of my closest friends died of asbestosis. And it was a dreadful thing to witness, obviously, you know, one of your best friends dying. But his attitude during it was extraordinary. He couldn't meet us as often as we would like, you know, obviously towards the end. But even after his first session of chemotherapy, you could tell he was so keen to tell us that how good the first pint of Guinness tastes after chemotherapy. You know, he just had to come down to the pub. The second pint was just a pint of Guinness, but he said the first pint was just unbelievable. I'd imagine it's a bit like being a heroin addict, actually. You'd go after, you know, that you'd be looking forward to chemo or whatever if it wasn't for the nausea, et cetera, et cetera. So I didn't really have a master plan or anything like that. I just thought, you know, again, Jimmy's attitude towards Jimmy has cancer of the bowel. And I was reading about cancer. I haven't had cancer myself, but I was reading about it and picking up a bit of knowledge and trying to actually find my way into it. And I was thinking, like myself, Jimmy would get impatient with, you know, medical detail. And I'm hopeless at remembering Latinate names. And I'm asked a question about, you know, I was ill myself once, not seriously. But my wife asked, and did the doctor say this? And the doctor said that. And, you know, I couldn't remember. I didn't, you know, I'm just sick. Leave me alone. And I know that I probably get quite impatient with medical detail. A friend of mine who died last year, sadly, her husband showed me her Kindle, and it was just full of books about cancer, you know. And I knew that was the way she went at it. She examined everything. She questioned everything. And she was brilliant in that way. It's part of what she was. But I wouldn't be like that myself. And it's not that I would lie down and die by any means, but I think put on the blinkers and say, here we go, you know, I'll face it this way. And Jimmy does that. And when you do that, when you live in Dublin, when the air is the air you breathe, you know, inevitably there's laughter. Inevitably there's laughter. It's how we face things. I don't know, you know, it's not uniquely Irish, obviously, or uniquely Dublin, but there's never... You know, I would imagine as well, at the height of the potato famine, there was the odd joke doing the rounds as well, you know, about starvation and, you know, the quality of the potatoes. So it's just I gradually got into that form, you know, and the poor old Outspan's days are numbered, you know, he's not going to survive. But I had been to the picnic about 5 times on the trot, and I was at it, you know, the one before last, I was there. I didn't take too many notes, but it was the one where Jimmy was going to be there with his friends, and the Cure were playing. And there was an inflatable chair. There were a lot of inflatable chairs lying around. And I thought, you know, I was near the back of the Cure because I wanted to go to something else. And I was listening away, thinking, Jesus, you know, Robert Smith has put on a few pounds there, and you know, the songs were still diddly diddly do, you know, good songs or whatever. But it just struck me, wouldn't it be great, like if Outspan was put up on that inflatable chair and propelled towards the stage over the heads of 30,000 people? And I thought to myself, I'd love that. Not now, because I'm not going to die anytime soon, I hope. But I'd love to think that if I was dying, I'd do daft things like that, and I'd be thrilled. And he is thrilled with it. He's thrilled because he was terrified, absolutely terrified, and he'd forgotten what that felt like. You know, so I don't plan these. I hazard a guess and think, well, that might work, and I just give it a go. But I'm glad you liked it. I mean, it was very nice of you to say that. Thank you.
Another question.
Questions for Wesley Stace. Just very simply, where did this new novel start, the story for you? Where did you come up with it? And
well, I have a 7-year-old and a 5-year-old, and a lot of people said to me, you know, oh, you've got kids now, maybe you will write a children's album, and which a lot of people do, because a lot of this kindy music and kids music comes out of a generation of people whose parents didn't understand or care about rock music, and so were quite happy for their kids to be listening to Sesame Street or Raffi, you know, whatever. Which I don't mean to make fun of at all, but, you know, it's kind of rather square music. And then the next generation comes through and they actually like rock music and would like their kids to be listening to something that they can bear to listen to in the car, which is why, you know, my son's listening to Iron Man by Black Sabbath in the car at the moment, because it's a way I can tie in his love of Iron Man with the fact that I like Black Sabbath. And but where the novel actually, that's kind of why the novel was written. I think it's my skewed version of making a kid's record. But where it came from originally is actually great. I was reading the New York Times, and there was an interview with the manager of the Wiggles. And the Wiggles, right? I don't need to explain the Wiggles. And the interviewer said to him, it was all about how huge the Wiggles are. And they wear these, you know, primary colours, and there's, you know, four of them. And they said, and the guy said, why, when the Wiggles do a meet and greet, do they always do the Wiggles dance when the photo is taken with the child? I suppose the question was, as opposed to, they were asking, is that policy? Because they always do this. They don't sit with the child on their lap. And the manager said, yes, they always do the Wiggles dance. And the guy said, why was that? And the Wiggles manager answered, rather frankly, I thought, that way you know where the hands are. And when I read that one phrase, just that one phrase, I wanted to write a novel about a band who didn't know. It's not whether the band are or are not paedophiles. That would be a very boring book to me. It's that they don't know to keep their hands up here. They don't, because there's no career path for them. They just don't know that it's all got to be evident. Their hands are elsewhere the whole time. They're having a good time doing the things they did at university and meeting the mothers. You know, they're doing everything wrong. And so really that's the two answers is because of the, you know, children's music and what I was listening to because of my kids, and also just this one very interesting article I read about the Wiggles. And then I just started to read more about it, and I've been interested in certain of my contemporaries making children's records, or last chance for a Grammy, as we call it in the industry. And I became interested in that phenomenon, and it just all kind of came together. One other small thing is that I've written a lot about music in all my books, but the first book's kind of about 18th century ballads a bit, and the second book's kind of about English vaudeville, and the third book's about classical composers and their relationships in the First World War. And I wanted to write very purely about music in a rather airy-fairy way, about composition and criticism and those kind of things. And I stacked up so many stories that I couldn't put in that book when I was writing it. And I just would write them down. And they were all stories from my horrible life of dressing rooms and broken strings and vans. And I just kept racking them up, and I suddenly thought, oh, these things all fit together. You know, this is this book with that band and those things.
The musical references, the bands you named and referred to.
When I was reading?
Yeah, yeah. There were bands I haven't actually heard mention of in 30 years.
Oh, Caravan?
Yeah. And
oh, you do in my house.
Yeah, Stackridge.
Stackridge.
Yeah, yeah. Yes. And I was wondering, you didn't have to Google to remind yourself, did you? Or were they at the front of your head?
Are you shitting me? Caravan are doing their first gig in America in 12 years on the 2nd of May in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. They're only playing one gig in the whole tour. One gig. And I will be there.
Good man.
That's my music.
Good man.
So, Wes, when does the kids album come out?
Yeah, I don't. I think probably not ever. Although one thing I have kind of worked out when I was making this thing, and also when I recorded, because I wrote 50 or so songs for my last album, that if you're doing kids' music right, and I should have no opinion on this at all, but if you're doing kids' music right, you're not writing for kids. Like, if you look at Dan Zanes' music, who is the premier kids' entertainer in America nowadays, it's grown-up music. He's just angling it at children. There's nothing idiotic about the lyrics or the songs he picked, like Pete Seeger. Mm. It's not music for kids. It's just that they're angling it towards kids, and it has a slightly positive message, I would say, would be the one thing that is the thread through it all, which kind of counts me out, actually. But be that as it may, I think there is probably, in the end, no real difference between it, you know, and any other song you might write.
Right. So, Roddy, you did something tantamount to putting a kid's album out when you were writing the... I can't remember the names of the books right now, but the children's books, mm-hmm. all the YA novels. It was prompted by stories that you wanted to tell your own children that
weren't out there. Yeah, I started the first one. I just wrote a few pages at the end of every working day just to read to my two sons at the time. I think they were 7 and 5, and there was a new baby in the house, their sister. And I just started. I noticed that when I told them stories, I didn't like the stories. I suppose it's the writer in me. I didn't like the spontaneity of it. I didn't like the fact that I didn't edit it, and I thought they were all a bit shite, but the kids loved them. And they loved them when their names were in them. So I gave them disguised versions. I gave them different versions of their names and just wrote this story, The Giggler Treatment, it's called. And then as they got older, I wrote slightly more sophisticated versions of the Gigglers as they got a little bit older and began to like Monty Python and Father Ted and things like that, you know, a bit of absurdity. And I wondered then, because my oldest child now is, my youngest actually is 16, so there's no, I've no children to write for anymore, so to speak, and I wondered whether I'd stop, but no, I haven't. I actually, whatever part of the imagination I can use for children's work, I actually quite enjoy doing it, you know, I really enjoy it. So I'll probably continue to do it. You know, but it was initially just for my children. It wasn't for anybody else.
Right. Okay, just curious.
I actually have a message from my children. This for you. This book is dedicated to my two children, Tilda and Wynne. You see, it says for Tilda and Wynne. And I said, I'm going out to read tonight. And my 7-year-old daughter said, but when you read that it's for us, they won't know, they won't understand that bit. And I was like, well, I'm not actually going to read that bit out loud. They think I'm reading the whole thing. And then she said, which was a real classic in the 7-year-old mind, she just got the word wrong and said, they won't understand that you've narrated it to us.
Brilliant.
And my wife and I just laughed quietly together and didn't say, the word is dedicated, you idiot. I didn't say that.
I got a letter very recently from a 10-year-old boy here in the United States, came to me in Dublin, and it starts off, Dear Roddy Doyle, I hope you are alive. And I am, just about.
How about some more questions? Yeah, there's a gentleman all the way back. Could you hold your hand up, sir? Keep it up? Yeah, Marion on that side.
This is for Mr. Doyle. You captured my attention in A Star Called Henry. And I was wondering, when you wrote that, did you have an idea of a sequence to Henry's life? Or when did you start thinking, I'm going to follow this up and go on to, you know, other phases of his life?
I had vague ideas. When I started the first book, A Star Called Henry, I had vague ideas where he was going to go. I knew that some point during the War of Independence in Ireland or soon after, he was going to have to leave Ireland. So I knew that would be the end of the first part of the story. And then as I got closer to that point, I began to think, well, where will he go? And I thought, well, he could go east to Europe or more likely follow the route of other people, go west to America, which is where I sent him. And I was over here in New York, actually, with my family, 1997, I think it was, when I was writing A Star Called Henry. And I read a review of a Louis Armstrong biography that just struck me as being interesting. And I bought it, and I read it, and I decided, you know, there was a coincidence. There were a lot of similarities, I thought, between my fictional character and Louis Armstrong, very much self-made, invented men, working on their image, and, you know, kind of quite happy to doctor the truth, you know. And I just thought that Armstrong was such a brilliant man and a misunderstood man, and I think, you know, a man whose intelligence, I think, was not appreciated, and a lot of assumptions made about him that were completely wrong because he was relatively unschooled, and of course he was black, that I just thought, well, I'd love Henry to meet this man. And that was the open door for the next book, you know. And then I thought, you know, John Ford, the film director, Irish-American, who gave, I suppose, the greatest depiction of Irish America's version of Ireland, which is The Quiet Man, which is a film I love. I really love it. I could recite it off by heart. I will if you want, including music. But it's those of us who live in Ireland, it's not really like that. But then again, now and again, it is. Like, it defies, you know, it's not, life in Ireland isn't supposed to be The Quiet Man, but then now and again, it just happens to be like that. But I thought that, you know, I knew a bit about the making of The Quiet Man and how long it took to make, and then the big entourage that left the States and arrived in Shannon Airport, and how, like, electricity came to the village of Cong just so that they could make the bloody film there. That's the only reason they got electricity. They'd still be in the dark today if it hadn't been for, you know, and all the preparations that were made and the stories and the legends all about it. And I did this incredible tour of the village of Cong where the film, some of the film was made. This Japanese man who'd done his master's on the making of The Quiet Man. And he'd actually, you know, arrived in Ireland and gone native. You know, Manzo, his name was. And he'd, you know, he'd go, "How are you, Seamus?" And they go, "How are you, Manzo?" And the most un-Japanese thing he did is that he used to, there's a golf course quite near Cong, he used to climb over the wall and play the last four holes because you couldn't see it from the clubhouse. You know, he'd do it for nothing and then climb back over the wall. And now there was a man who went native, if you know. So that got me into the last book, you know, but I didn't plan to. I knew it was going to, he was going to leave, go to America, and then he was going to come back to a different Ireland. And it was about who holds the definition of what it is to be Irish, you know? Because that shifted and changed so much throughout my life, as I'm sure it has here as well. You know, I read an article very recently, the strange conclusion of it was that, in fact, Barack Obama is to the right of Richard Nixon. That's a weird conclusion. But actually, it does bear analysis. And that's happened in most of our lifetimes, you know, how things have shifted and changed here in this country. And the same, of course, in everybody's. But I live in Dublin, so, and we're coming up to an interesting time, the 100th anniversary of 1916. And that'll be interesting as to who will, if you like, control that, you know. So all these things were percolating in my head, and a lot of family history and family legends, you know, who fought for who and who died and who missed the bus so didn't go to the 1916 rising and went to the horse races instead, all this stuff that I grew up hearing about. So that's where the ideas came from.
Wes, do you have a sense of the trajectory of a book when you begin it?
It's interesting, isn't it? No, I mean, I think I might have even sat on this very stage and told this before, but I think there are some very notable writers who I basically have a problem with because their characters, you know, it's what they planned out at the beginning, and you know that they meant they preordained this particular thing to happen at about two-thirds of the way through the book. And I think that takes a lot of control and is probably admirable in some ways, but I think it can also leave very dead on the page characters. Because my experience, and I mean, you know, I've just made the same mistakes over and over again in books and will do for the rest of the time I write them, which is totally fine with me, apparently. But what I find is that, you know, you think of what might be about to happen or the kickoff or kind of some of the story, and then when you write the characters, it's not some kind of a hippie thing where they just become real. But they, as the more you flesh them out, the more you give them a... you know, the more they come up with their own reasons for doing things, because they're a better character than they were when you first thought of them. They've done something that you didn't expect, and so they become a richer thing. And in that way, I then feel it starts to get bad, because they don't do the things that you thought they were going to previously do, because they're richer and better. And so I've kind of... I think my plots are pretty freewheeling, despite... being extremely complicated. So I don't quite know how that all comes about, but there's a little bit of melodrama that I always have to have in my books that I like a lot. It's always about families. I know the stuff it's about, but the plots I don't really work out terribly much.
Yes, for Wes, I, speaking on the characters, I did just finish By George, and I really enjoyed all of the characters in the book, and kind of the way you told it through the two different Georges, the boy and the boy dummy. Did you kind of do that on purpose to help, you know, keep you off guard as far as exactly what the characters were going to do? Because I couldn't predict what was going to happen.
So it's so interesting really you mentioned good. By George today, because it's all I've been talking about and thinking about today. So many people mentioned it to me. It's a strange day for By... Even you mentioned to me. It's a strange day for By George. But I think all my books basically are about really pretentious things. Deep down, that's where the ideas come from. They come from... Each one of them comes from a very... That I then... don't want that to seem like the focus of the book on any level, because I just want them to be about characters doing what they do. Like, you know, Misfortune is as deep as exploration of gender and, you know, sexual proclivities of various things that I could possibly manage. And I read a lot of extremely pretentious stuff and philosophy to make what in the end is, I think... you know, kind of a Dickensian romp, really. But by the same token, By George started up... There was a review of a Peter Carey book called The Kelly Gang. It always has on the back of that book, or it does in England, but it's an American quote, an amazing piece of literary ventriloquism, written by somebody who wrote for the New York Times. Can't remember. He's someone very famous. And I remember reading that and thinking, yeah, that's what novels are. Just that one sentence ago, that's what novels are. They're all ventriloquism. And then I thought, so why isn't there a novel about ventriloquism? Why isn't there a novel where you take that metaphor and just strip it of that, and what it's about is about literary voice? So the whole point of By George is, there's no reason you should know this. Half of it is narrated by a ventriloquist dummy in the Second World War, and half of it is narrated by a boy with the same name in the 1970s and 80s or something like that. Now, it's either in a novel you can do anything. You can have a ventriloquist dummy narrate a novel. Not a problem. Not a problem. I mean, you can posit anything you want in a novel, and that is what the world is. The question is that what's happening, or is there some kind of psychological reality to this dummy narrating? You've finished the book, right? Well, obviously I won't give anything away. But the point is, it's about narrative voice and how one trusts in it. So... that rather pretentious idea I had in the first place becomes, I think, and I hope you have found, with the, you know, with these various ways I have of dealing with it, into a very unpretentious idea that's about, you know, finding your own voice, if you will. And the boy in the modern day is struck dumb, literally, whereas the ventriloquist dummy keeps on talking in a very invasive way. And it, of course, that bit Dead of Night, the movie, where the ventriloquist dummy comes to life. You know, so that's kind of what I was going for. Also, ventriloquist dummies are just spooky. Looking back, it was a very good idea for a book, but one that too many people were freaked out just by the fact it was about ventriloquist dummies. I mean, the hold of a ventriloquist dummy How can that be scary? It's the most ludicrously crappy illusion of all time. It's weird, you know, and there's a certain distasteful aspect to it. Anyway, what was the question? That was it, right? I answered that. Thank you very much for asking me about By George.
Well, sadly, we are. We'll take one more question, and then we're going to wrap up. Yeah, somebody want to get this lady in front of Mike?
This question's for Roddy. So many of your books, you've done like series or follow-ups. Is that something you liked reading yourself?
I'm not sure.
You like to find out how characters got on later on?
I loved those at the Zuckerman novels, you know. Such a joy to know. And I didn't read them as they were published because I was too young, but it was such a joy to find out, oh, there's more. You know, oh, it's brilliant, there's more. You know, it's a bit like a child, really. You know, oh, geez, a whole series of them, Enid Blyton, Christ. Those children must be 72 by now, and they're still having adventures. You know, no, so it's great in that regard. But I didn't have any sort of a master plan, but I suppose with the exception perhaps of A Star Called Henry and those Henry books, I don't leave bodies on the floor at the end of books. People die, they die naturally, but there's a lot of the characters alive at the end of the books. I like that notion, you know, life goes on, you know. But John Wayne at the end of The Searchers, you know. It's not necessarily happy ending, but life goes on. And so they were, I remember when I consciously decided to do it, I mean, I wrote The Commitments and then wrote about Jimmy's sister in The Snapper, and then I decided, well, I'll have a boat go at the father. So that was three. I thought enough is enough. But my fifth novel is The Woman Who Walked Into Doors, and I had no intention of going back to that character. But about 10 years after I'd finished it, Ireland had changed so much. And I was thinking, you know, how will I... I'd like to write a book about the boom, but I don't want to write about a satirical thing about people with money and, you know, a bit slightly superior, snooty look at, you know, people's prosperity because, you know, I was doing okay myself. So, and as well as that, it's not the way I see things. So I thought, well, Paula in The Woman Who Walked Into Doors was a house cleaner, an office cleaner. Her perspective would be interesting because what happened in those intervening 10 years is that when you went to see, you know, if you ever saw offices being cleaned or if you ever saw people's houses being cleaned, it was East Europeans and Africans who were doing it now. African men were doing cleaning apartments and things like that. They were turning up dressed as if to go to the office and then changing into their clothes, work clothes, and then turning but getting into suits again and going home. So I found that interesting, you know, well, from a novelist's point of view, interesting. So I thought, well, Paula would be a really interesting guide through a year, you know, in the mid, I think it was 2004 when I started that novel. It became Paula Spencer because I couldn't think of a better name for the book. So I deliberately went back to her, and I was delighted I did because I think she was well worth revisiting, I think, and adding the 10 years to her life and adding the 10 years to her children's lives. And, you know, so it was well worth doing. There was plenty of meat there, so to speak. And I'd be open to going back to her again. You know, it's not a plan as such, but it's certainly something I would do. I could go back to Jimmy Rabbit, give him a few years, see how he's getting on, you know, or his children. So they're all there to be used. They don't have any existence whatsoever off the page, if you like. They're all words. So it's not as I don't have them stored away somewhere and I'm not thinking, how are they getting on? They don't exist, you know, but I think if they do serve a purpose, I can use them. So I'd be open to going back to them. Then I might just, I haven't written a novel in a while because I've been doing other work, and that's unusual enough for me, but I might just decide to invent a totally new person because I haven't done that in a while.
Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking Roddy Doyle and
Les Bates. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.